time in the country. We're glad that you dropped by. Spend some time in the country, leave your worries behind. There's lots of fun for everyone, the best in music too. Spend some time in the country, we've been waiting here for you. Here in the country, waiting here for you.
Live from Ontario and heard around the world, welcome to In the Country with Dave Woods. This is the place for up-close and personal interviews, as well as great country music from our featured guests. So sit back and relax. Today's show starts right now.
On this show, we'll follow the journey of a song, several songs, in fact, written by Canada's Larry Wayne Clark. He'll take us from the initial ideas through to the final versions, with all the exciting steps in between and the hits that followed. During the show, you'll be hearing two of the songs that Larry will be talking about. So get set to hear all about the story behind the country song. Welcome to the show, Larry.
Hi there, Dave. Thank you.
It's great to have you on. And first of all, congratulations on your recent induction into the British Columbia Country Music Association Hall of Fame.
Well, thank you very much. That was quite an honor, actually. I was more moved by it than I thought I would be. there were a total of 10 people who were inducted that same night, and most of them were friends of mine. You know, we were basically of the same era for the most part. I mean, there was one person who was inducted posthumously, but for the most part, these were people who I had rubbed elbows with, and there were radio people, and there was a photographer, and Jeff Lee, who is a great country singer, and so forth. You know, quite an array of people, and there was me.
Sounds like a great representation, I guess, of all the years you've done as a producer, songwriter, even a music journalist, leading to this moment. And I know your love of songs goes back, because I've read on your website, and we've talked before, just how early on in life you really fell in love with songs and just the whole mystery behind them and the magic of them. Can you touch a bit on that, Larry, before we get into specific songs? And we're going to touch on songs that you've had recorded by Lee Greenwood, Chris Young, Bobby Wills, Bootleg, an early hit, as well as Robin Scott.
Yeah, which is an interesting cross-section of people, covering probably probably about 15 years in my life and career. I don't know what it is. I was always fascinated by songs, and it was just something I found out by happenstance. I mean, everybody grows up listening to the radio and listening to TV and movies. I mean, you know, songs are everywhere. Now I'm going back to the 50s and 60s when entertainment in all its, you know, manifestations wasn't quite as prevalent as it is today. I mean, you know, you didn't have 100 stations on your TV. You probably had one or two, and radio in those days was mono, and it was, the formats were very blurry. I mean, a single station would tend to play quite a broad cross section of stuff, which I'm very grateful for, actually.
Right.
I just found that I had a very deep identification with songs, and they were in my head all the time. I'd hear something on the radio, and I would be totally infected by it. You know, it would just be with me all day. It'd be with me when I was walking around. I'd be, I'd be hearing the song in my head, and I'd actually find that I'd be walking faster, or sometimes almost running, because I had this sort of internal rhythm going on. I can't explain it. I mean, I didn't come from a particularly musical family. There were no instruments around when I was when I was growing up, until in my teens when I bought a guitar for myself. But I just had this strong attraction to songs and to other forms of you know, I liked movies and I liked any kind of a story. I was always a reader. But there's something about a song and the way that it can set the whole universe to order in a few little minutes that just fascinates me.
Right. And the first song we're going to talk about of the five is a song recorded by Bootleg, released in 89, and it actually won in that year the BCCMA Song and Single of the Year. You actually performed this recently at your Hall of Fame induction there as well. So tell us about this song. This is one that we're going to share on the show as well. But tell us how the song came about.
The basic idea, I can remember this quite clearly, you know, the idea for the title, that came from, I was living in Vancouver at the time, and which really is where it all began for me. It's where my career, it's not my native province, but I moved there in 1980, and it was where everything began for me in terms of a musical career. And that's why this Hall of Fame induction was so moving and you know, in a way so apt. But at that time, I had started getting a bit of a reputation as a writer and producer, and was writing songs quite avidly, mostly by myself at that time. Didn't co-write much, and I went one time. Maggie and I went down to Jericho Park in Vancouver, where the folk festival, I assume it still takes place there. At that time, it took place in Jericho Park, and we weren't we didn't have passes. We weren't actually on the premises, but you could hear things if you were just walking in the area. And the group Riders in the Sky were performing that year, and I always really liked them. And they had a little bit of shtick that they did. Something to the effect of, you know, it's not the easy way, but it's the cowboy way, and they would do that quite often throughout their set. And I remember I had that in my head walking home that night, and thinking, you know, there's probably a song in there somewhere, but of course I didn't want to quote the saying exactly as they had it, and somehow that. That became modified to the cowboy thing to do, and I sat down and wrote it not long afterward. And I wanted to get somebody to sing on a demo of it, and the band Bootleg was very popular at that time in BC. They had a couple of singers in the band, one of whom was a guy named Jerry King, who had a really remarkable gravelly sort of voice and sounded extremely American. It sounded like an American character actor or something. And Jerry used to get a lot of work doing commercials and so forth. And I approached him and said, you know, I'd like you to sing in this song. We'd become casual friends by that time. And so he did sing the demo, and he played it for the band, and the band liked it, and they started doing it live. Did it quite differently from the way I had demoed it, and then they were working on completing an album, and eventually did so. And this song became the only thing on that album that wasn't written by the band. So that was quite flattering in itself.
Very. And they released it as, you mentioned that they did it a bit different than the demo. Do you find that does that come up very often, where someone loves the song but decides to do something a little different with it as far as the rhythm or the overall style?
It does happen, although I would say more often than not what happens is, especially if the demo is a good one and a professionally done one, so often people will just try and copy the demo, which is kind of disappointing in a way, but that happens a lot. But in this case, I give them credit. They totally heard this differently. They had a steel guitar in the band, and this was their most recent member, and I think they were looking for ways to give him lots of stuff to do, and so the single that they cut was drenched with steel guitar, whereas my demo didn't have any.
Okay.
And you know, other than the singer being, of course, the same person, Jerry was also a great whistler, and he whistles at the end of this song, which is very powerful. And it sounds a bit dated today, but it still has enormous charm. I mean, even when it was released, it was a bit retro. You know, they were deliberately going for that, I think. But the song did remarkably well. It was played all across Canada. I believe it was a top five country single across Canada. And in many ways, it became my calling card. A lot of people considered this my shining moment. I got a lot of very positive strokes and made some money off this, and became good friends with the guys from Bootleg. Jerry King, unfortunately, has passed away in the interim. He contracted cancer and died way too young. But so that adds a poignancy to the song, which is already a goodbye song. You know, it's already dealing with a parting of the ways, and of course now the history or the song has sort of grown into its own reality or something. So
songs can change over the years as far as the song stays the same, but whoever is singing it. The song can come to represent certain things, I guess, over the years, and a song can grow to have more meaning than when it was initially released.
Absolutely. And you have to have been doing this somewhere near as long as I have to fully appreciate that, but that's absolutely true. Something that you wrote as, merely a work of imagination suddenly is abrim with truth, with a kind of verity that it never had back at the time of its inception, and that's
a
fascinating thing. And
was this your first songwriting awards for this song, or were there previous ones?
This was the first songwriting award. I won several Producer of the Year awards when I was in BC. And I had already won one of those, maybe two at this time, but I had never been recognized purely as a songwriter. So that was unique and very gratifying.
Well, let's share the song now, Larry, and let everybody hear the song from 1989 by Bootleg that you wrote. This is one that you wrote all by yourself. And then we're going to come back and talk about some other great songs of yours that have been recorded, including songs by Lee Greenwood, Chris Young, and a couple others. Right now, this is Bootleg, and the song is called The Cowboy Thing to Do.
You always knew which way the plot would go. You saw the maverick in my eyes. Like that lone rider on the Late Late Show. I got no time for long goodbyes. I needed shelter and a place to hide. I saw your light, found your door. My wounds are healing, now it's time to ride. That's what God made sunset for. Just a wandering drop of dew. Just on the trail, the reason I can't speak. I'll ride off into the blue, that I won't look back at you. That ain't a cowboy thing to do. You see pasture, I see open plain. You want a home, I can't stand walls. This time's tomorrow when you curse my name, I'll be a memory right until ever. It's only raining, it's glistening on my cheek, or just a wandering drop of dew. Dust on the trail of the reason I can't speak. I'll ride off into the blue, and I won't look back at you. That ain't a cowboy thing to do. I'll ride off into the blue, girl, I won't look back at you. That just ain't the cowboy thing to do.
And that is Bootleg with The Cowboy Thing to Do. We are getting up close and personal with the songs of Larry Wayne Clark. And that is a great song, a beautiful song that takes you through an emotional journey.
Yeah, it's actually quite poetic and abstract. I mean, I can't imagine myself writing that song today, but at the time, I don't know, it seemed to connect with people. I had all kinds of wonderful response to that song, and I came to like it a whole lot, and it was fun to do it the other night at this Hall of Fame induction. And in fact, I did it with Ron Irving, who was the leader of the band Bootleg. He wasn't the guy who sang on this particular song, but he was the band's leader and chief songwriter. And we've been friends forever now, and in fact, I was staying with him and his wife while I was out there, and he got up with me and played a second guitar as we did this song, and it was very emotional, very emotional. I have a lot of fond memories of that time, and this song helps to mark them.
Yeah, it's a great one, and Ron Irving, who you mentioned a moment ago, comes up in our next song we're going to be talking about, recorded around 1991 and released then by Lee Greenwood. The song is Between a Rock and a Heartache. You wrote it along with Ron Irving and David Simmons. The song is very catchy, and it's got a great title, and I'll let you talk about the song, of course, but Between a Rock and a Heartache.
Well, at this time, this was probably within a year of the whole cowboy thing to do release and success, and Ron and I were getting together on a fairly frequent basis. I mean, we were two of the few people in BC at that time who were trying to be songwriters on a grander scale than just writing songs for yourself. I mean, he did that with his own band, but he wanted to have a big Kenny Rogers release he wanted the big artists to be doing his songs, and so did I. I mean, I never aspired to be an artist. So Ron and I were pretty fated to get together, I would say, and we would on a fairly frequent basis. And he called me up one day, and he said, "What do you think of Between a Rock and a Hard Place as a song title?" And of course, I was familiar with that expression, and I said, well, you know, it's mm-hmm. it's a neat expression, and people know it. So, you know, it might work. But I was mulling it over, and we talked for a while and then got off the phone. And I called him back a little bit later, and I said, have you actually got a tune going with, you know, along with this title? And he said, yeah, I've been working on something, and he played it for me. And with the cadences of the melody, you know, I suggested that maybe we could try playing with that title and make it Between a Rock and a Heartache, which, you know, is a very country thing to do. You take mm-hmm. a common saying and you twist a couple of words.
Yeah, exactly.
And he really liked that. He said, yeah, I really like that. I should mention that, and he told me this right at the beginning, the idea had been sent to him by a friend of his on Vancouver Island named David Simmons. I, to this day, have never met David Simmons. But David was the one who had suggested the initial idea. So anyway, Ron came over sometime in the next couple of days, and we sat down and wrote what was what became Between a Rock and a Heartache. And Dave Simmons is credited with writing on it too, because, you know, it originated with him, but he was not there in the room with us, and we did a demo using Jerry King to sing it, sent it down to Nashville, a producer named Jerry Crutchfield, who Ron had a relationship with, and he liked it and said, yeah, I'd like to cut that on Lee Greenwood. And he did so, and made a pretty nifty little record of it that I came to like a whole lot, especially when it was just being played to death in the Vancouver area for a time.
Mm-hmm.
Just every time I put the radio on, I was hearing it. And it wasn't a huge hit in the States, but it definitely was on the charts. And it was... As far as I know, I believe it was Lee Greenwood's last charting single, because his career was...
Yeah, that was around the early 90s, and he, of course, had a big heyday in the 80s and probably, as you said, through the early 90s as far as radio airplay.
Yeah, he was pretty big there for a time. But,
yeah.
His career was somewhat on the wane at this time, but this one got pretty good attention, and then it got synchronized to... an episode of Walker, Texas Ranger, and that was running for years, you know, different countries and whatnot would run it in translation. So we were making royalties off of that. And, you know, overall, over a period of time, the thing actually did okay for us. And I've always liked the record. I think Jerry made a terrific record of the song. And,
yeah, very catchy. How important is the demo in the process? For example, in this case, how important was having the right demo and choosing the right demo singer to sell the song, to pitch it when you're doing that for the artist? How important is that?
Well, I think in the case of this song, it was it probably worked to our advantage that we had a fully produced demo. I mean, we hadn't spent a lot of money on it. Something where, if I'm remembering correctly, I programmed the drum machine and played everything on there.
Oh, wow!
And Jerry came in and sang it, and Ron and I did a couple of background vocals. That was something I did a lot of then, was these sort of one man band demos, and really enjoyed that for a time, and then I got really sick of it. But that's how that was done. But it was a good demo. It definitely had a spark to it, and people were saying good things about it right from the beginning. We started playing it around, so when Jerry Crutchfield jumped on it, I mean I won't say it wasn't a surprise, but it wasn't a total surprise, because we really thought we had something with that song. And,
now, when you were writing it, did you have someone in mind? Was it a Kenny Rogers, Lee Greenwood type, or were you just, you know, hoping for the top male artist of the time, that kind of thing?
Very good question. I honestly don't remember who we might have been casting that for mentally. Kenny Rogers probably was mentioned because Ron was a big fan of Kenny Rogers and was always wanting to get a Kenny Rogers cut. He never did. But, But you know, we probably mentioned Kenny. It was you know, it had a slight gospel feel to it, and there was a bass voice part that I, you know, way down deep kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it could have worked for Kenny. I honestly don't think Lee Green would ever enter the picture when we were discussing it, but you know, we were happy to have him do it.
That's always the great surprise, right? I mean, obviously it's great to get a cut, but it's great to have that surprise of, you know, who is actually recording it, because as you said, you don't always know who is going to end up with putting it out and releasing it and so forth.
Well, every now and again, something really imaginative will happen, and somebody will cut a song that you would never have, you know, anticipated, and you know,
right.
Sometimes a male song may be turned female for the purposes of a cut, and you know, there are occasionally some surprises, and some of them pleasant surprises, not all of them, but yeah, it's...
Because it's your baby, right? This song is something that you care about and you've put your heart and soul into, so you do care about what happens to it when someone records it. So if it's not a great version, you're going to, you know, you're going to be affected by that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, especially in the earlier days of one's career, you know, when you don't have hundreds of songs under your belt, I mean, you take everything very, very seriously. And,
right.
And that's, you know, that's as it should be. I mean, you have to take pride in what you're doing if you're going to become adept at doing it. So
yeah, for sure.
We were, but this one worked out very well for us, and for Ron and I both.
And all these songs, I'll suggest to our listeners.
That was my first,
a couple. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Larry.
I was just going to say it was my first Nashville success. It was the first major label Nashville cut that I'd had, so it was very, very significant in that regard.
For sure. I was just going to add that to any of the songs, a couple of we are sharing on the show, but for the ones we talk about, I encourage our listeners to go to iTunes and check out the song, listen to a sample, buy the song, or however you want to find a way of hearing it. Definitely check the songs out, because it's very interesting to hear the stories and then, of course, listen to the songs, you know, a little bit more about what went into it. The next one we're going to turn to, co-written along with Chris Young and recorded by him, and Chris has had huge hits recently, a new song called Tomorrow, which is beautiful on the charts, a song a while back called Getting You Home. Talk about the great song Drinking Me Lonely that you and Chris wrote.
Well, we had begun writing when Chris was, I think he was still in high school. I think he's about 17 and, you know, just about to graduate high school. And it turned out that he was a big Buddy Jewel fan. And Buddy Jewel and I were friendly, and we had written a bunch of songs together. And Buddy, that year, was on Nashville Star. And I used to occasionally go to a chat board, CMT thing, that talked about Nashville Star and the various people on there. And I noticed that there was a guy named Chris who seemed to know a lot of people on that you know, on that list of chatters, and occasionally I'd see comments like, you know, Chris, you're a great singer yourself. Chris is a big Buddy Jewel fan. He was always singing Buddy's praises on there, but people were always talking about what a good singer Chris was. I knew nothing about this guy, but I checked him out on, I found a website, and lo and behold, here was this guy who was still in his teens, and there were a couple of musical samples, and he sounded really good. He had this big, mellifluous voice, very country, and we traded a couple of emails, and I said, you know, I'm a friend of Buddy's, and we co-write a lot together, and I think you and I should get together, and he agreed. So he started coming over to my place periodically, and we wrote a bunch of songs, and probably a couple of years later, he did an independent album. I think probably five of our co-writes were on there. So we were writing some pretty good stuff, and you know, songs that I'm still pitching. He came to me one day with this idea, "Drinking Me Lonely." He liked that title, and he had roughed out a bit of a melody for it, but I guess had gotten stuck on it, or for whatever reason he brought it to me, and we sat down and wrote it, and it was quite magical. A lot of that to do with how well he sang it. And, you know, he's mm-hmm. always had that really good falsetto flip that he does. He kind of borrows that from Marty Robbins. And,
right.
And he, you know, he learned how to play it and started doing it live. And I remember Chris's stepfather coming up to me at a gig one time and saying, you know, that's the best thing you guys have written right there. That's far
wow.
from my favorite. And so, you know, I began to realize that we probably did have something a little bit special there. And then, however long afterward, maybe a year or thereabouts, Chris went on National Star and performed the song on that show and actually mm-hmm. gave me credit for it, which I appreciated, and people were just loving it, and from that point, he sort of became the front runner. People were saying, yeah, I think Chris Young has got this sewn up, and sure enough, he won that year, and got a record deal, and went in the studio with Buddy Cannon, and they recorded "Drinking Me Lonely" and a bunch of other things, and this was his first single, and they did a video of it. It was performed on the Jay Leno show. It was performed on the Grand Ole Opry, the televised
wow.
Grand Ole Opry. yeah, there were a lot of firsts with that, and it was probably the first time that I became aware of things like ringtones and
right.
these things
have you
that
ever
have
heard
become.
Have you ever heard a ringtone of one of your songs somewhere?
I haven't actually. I don't think I've actually heard "Drinking Me Lonely." I think it's the only one that's ever been made into a ringtone. But, it was. You know, we collected some royalties on that, and it was. You know, there was a karaoke track and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, there are some things that happen when you when you have a release on a major label like that. That you know. Probably aren't going to happen when you have independent stuff.
Yeah,
so
and it's such a well-written song now. Of course, a well-written song still needs to have a singer who puts that emotional connection to the song. Have you seen that specifically here, but even with some of your other songs where it was a great song, but it was the fact that the singer brought that emotional connection to the song that took it, you know, to that level that makes it a hit?
Well, I think any time I've had a song that's succeeded to any degree, there's been a singer attached to it who brought something special to the table. You know, I think that's just part of the whole package that goes into making something a popular song, perhaps even a hit song. You know, there have to be various ingredients, and I think one of them is that the audience really has to believe the singer,
right.
especially if it's a ballad. The audience really has to identify and believe that this person is telling some sort of truth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that definitely happened with Chris Young doing this song. I mean, I still think, I personally, and I mean, you know, obviously I'm not impartial here, but I still think that the best vocal that he's done yet. I mean, he's had bigger hits, you know, as his career has grown, and, you know, he's really quite big right now. He's enjoying success, but I think that just lick for lick, that vocal, I don't think has been surpassed, and I can't see how it could be surpassed. You know, it's just
yeah.
such a good blend of singer and song, and
yeah,
you know, you dream of that. I mean, that really is very, very important.
Yeah, that's the reason you're right to have your song put in the hands and the voice of someone like that who delivers and has the song live up to the reason you wrote it and the kind of emotion you wanted to evoke in others.
Yeah, and you know, I guess in a way, it's easier if the singer is also a co-writer on the song. I mean, you know, Chris is very much a part of the genesis of this song. But you know, in the other two examples we talked about, the singer was not a co-writer, and you know, Jerry King did a wonderful job in the cowboy thing, and you know, Lee Greenwood was very convincing on Between a Rock and a Heartache. So. You know, you don't have to write it with the artist, but in many ways, especially in today's recording world, that is a wise thing to do if you can find a singer who does in fact write or is at least aspiring to be a writer, and you can you can get on board. I mean, that's that is becoming very much part and parcel of what. Of what people are doing nowadays to get their songs cut.
Exactly. Well, we've got a couple more songs to talk about. A song, I Want to Live Like That, sung by Robin Scott. Also, Thank God for Second Chances, sung by Bobby Wills. I also want to get a few moments to talk about some songwriting tips you might have to pass on. But first, we're going to start by playing one of the songs, Larry, and then we'll come back and talk about it. So we'll do it in kind of reverse. We'll let our listeners hear the song. And this is Robin Scott, and the song is I Want to Live Like That. And then we'll come back and get the story behind the country song.
Be there for my friends. I want to always make amends. I want to live like that. I want to laugh right out loud. I want to make my mama proud. I want to have the strength to cry. I want to always wonder why. I want to live like that. I wanna live that way. I don't wanna be afraid. I want love like that. Every day I wanna live like that. I wanna be heard when I pray. I wanna slow dance in the I don't wanna
And we are taking the journey of a song courtesy of Larry Wayne Clark. The singer there is Robin Scott. The song is I Want to Live Like That. And a song that the lyrics really stand out. As great as the melody is, the lyrics are really telling us something and giving us a message. Tell us about you and the co-writer on it, Larry, and the formation of the song.
Yeah, this is a story I remember very fondly. I wrote this with Kathy Ann McClintock, who is a singer-songwriter from Vancouver, and I knew her in Vancouver. At that time, she was singing with a sort of a bluegrass, kind of a progressive bluegrass band called Tumbleweed, and she had a very she had a very nice voice. It's a small voice, you know. It's a voice that sort of makes you lean forward to hear it better. And I knew her for years, and she was doing some writing and performing with this band. And she eventually got married and married one of the guys in the band. Anyway, in the meantime, Maggie and I moved down to Nashville and sort of lost touch with Kathy Ann, but. Then it turned out that she split up with the guy in the band that she had married, and the band itself kind of faded away. And in the meantime, she had met an American guy named Stephen McClintock, who was a songwriter and producer and a performer. And you know, they met, and sparks flew, and Kathy Ann started coming down to Nashville, and. Eventually, they got married and had a child. And Kathy Ann kind of surprised me. She said, "You know, you and I should get together and write." And we had never done this in Vancouver. I mean, at that time, she was, you know, this little sort of bluegrass girl who wrote songs all by herself. And but I guess being around Stephen, she had sort of gotten the bug to be a little bit more of a commercial songwriter and to you know, to network and work with other people and whatnot. So
right.
I said, yeah, that'd be great. So she came over to our place, and I can still see that she brought their little daughter, who was probably not even a year old at that time. And Kathy Ann had one of these portable playpens, which she set up in my dining room, and we sat at the table, and Tessa just amused herself for the next few hours. And Kathy Ann had a little tape recorder, and she played me some stuff that she had laid down a cappella. She can play a bit of guitar, but it's not her inclination to do that. I think most of her writing she kind of does a cappella, and she had a few scattered phrases, you know, I want to always make amends. I remember that being there and be there for my friends. And she had a few of these scattered phrases. They weren't really put to order. And so the first thing we did was start sort of outlining them and adding a few more and starting to build a song out of that, and eventually got to you know, adding a chorus, and you know, it was something quite magical. I think we both knew that, and she went home that day, and I remember that she started performing it at writers' nights almost immediately. I wasn't even sure the song was finished, and she was out there performing it, and people were loving it. So
right.
You know, we knew we had something, and eventually she did a demo. She and Stephen, him doing a bit of harmony and playing the guitar for her, just a little acoustic demo, but very, very magical. And we sent it out, you know, various places. And a friend of mine named Jim Hobson, who lives there in Ontario, he's sort of up the 400 corridor from where you are.
Right. I think he used to be DJ Hobson.
Yes, exactly.
Yep.
And he had opened the studio and was always looking for songs, and I sent him this one, and he said, you know, I want to cut this on this girl, Robin Scott, terrific singer. I'd never heard of her, and but she's from Belleville, Ontario, and I don't think I'd ever done any recording, but they wanted to do an album, and her family was involved, and anyway, she turned out to be a really good singer, just a nice, natural, almost Anne Murray-ish kind of quality there. And I really liked what she did. It was Thomas Wade that produced the side.
Oh, wow.
And they released it to radio, and it got very good airplay. I mean, for an unknown independent artist, it got very good airplay coast to coast, this back about 91. And so, you know, I was very happy about that. And I, unfortunately, Robin Scott didn't maintain her career very long. She started having babies, and to my knowledge, is just not doing anything now, and maybe some local stuff in Belleville. But I really
sure.
thought she had the goods. I thought that she sounded great. And the interesting thing about this song is this has become, hands down, our most requested copyright that we have. I mean, this has been recorded for demo purposes and independent recordings and what have you. It's been recorded over 40 times.
Wow.
I mean, I've got versions of this
That's
song.
Amazing.
I've got pop versions. I've got bluegrassy versions. I've got gospel-y versions. I've got guys doing it, groups doing it. And, and yet it's never been a huge, million-dollar hit or
right.
anything like that. But
it must be so interesting to hear the different incarnations of the song. As you said, a male singer, then a group, Robin Scott's version. So it must be interesting each time.
It is, although it's frustrating. You know, every time we get another cut on it, we think, you know, when are we going to get a great big one?
Get the big cut, yeah.
We almost had one that was a Capitol Records artist in Nashville that cut it, and there was some enthusiasm, but then she lost her deal, and it was never released. And but I still really favor that Robin Scott version, and that's why I pick that one. You know, there are many others I could choose from, but that one did have a certain amount of commercial success, and I think she really nailed it. And you know, it's a song that has a message that speaks to everybody. I mean, a lot of young people have cut this. You know, it's been cut by young teenagers and whatnot because it's just a song about life and, you know, the various mm-hmm. aspects. And I think Kathy Ann at that time, you know, with her new baby and her new marriage and having gotten to a certain age, I think she was very much, you know, looking at the big picture. And, you know, that's where the idea probably stemmed from.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, and this is everything from mothers, daughters, you know, everybody seems to find something in there to relate to because
mm-hmm.
the message is quite broad, really.
For sure. Now, we're going to talk about our final song, Thank God for Second Chances, which you wrote with Aaron Bates and was recorded by Bobby Wills. But before we get to that, can you throw out a couple of songwriting tips, Larry, maybe that some come to mind, maybe common mistakes beginner songwriters might make or just things you got to look out for when you're writing, maybe sort of some general comments?
Well, of course, I could go on all day with this kind of stuff, and you know, I do get asked
sure.
a lot of these questions. You know, I find with new writers, they're either overconfident or not confident enough. You know, they're writing songs that in some cases just aren't all that good. They're kind of mediocre, but these writers think they've got something brilliant there, and it's hard to dissuade them from that and to convince them that they need to take a harder look at what they do and compare it with the best that's out there and, you know, does it really compare at that level? And then on the other hand, you get people who don't have enough confidence in what they do. You know, they're coming up with some good ideas and but they don't finish them. You know, they get discourages you, they hit a brick wall, they put something aside, and, you know, they get bits and pieces of songs all over them, maybe dozens of them. And basically they run out of steam. They run out of whatever whatever confidence, whatever, you know, burst of inspiration got the ball rolling in the first place, that, you know, that will run out. I mean, you have to learn to write in a fairly objective way at times. Sometimes the muse will be with you, and you know, you'll feel your skin tingling a little bit.
Right.
You're really reacting to the process. But other times you just have to do it because you're not finished. You got another verse to write, or you know something is wrong with that bridge, or the song is running too long.
Yep.
That you see people's eyes rolling when you play it for them. You know, it's there's a point where people lose interest. You know, you have to become really, really good at reading all those signs and you know, learning when you've got something good happening, learning how you can make it better, learning when you should just leave it alone. Sometimes you're just flogging a dead horse. You've got something that just isn't going to work. So, you know, there's a lot to be said for that. Just trying to gain that objective ear and learning to play songs for other people selectively. I mean, you know, there are people who are always going to tell you your work is great, you know, your mother and father and wife and husband and all that. You know, you're a lot of people you just aren't going to get objective reaction from.
Right.
In some cases, that's not true. I mean, there are parents and there are spouses who have that ability to give good constructive feedback. But for the most part, you know, try and get out there and play your songs for people who don't have a vested interest in you and who seem to know what they're talking about. You become very good. I certainly know this is true of me. You become very good at playing a song for somebody and hearing it sort of through their ears. You can tell when the energy is connecting between
mm-hmm.
what's being played and the person
yeah.
that's being played. You can feel it in the air when there's a connection being made. And by the same token, you feel it when there isn't.
When they're not, right.
So, yeah.
That is
you really
great
have
advice
to...
Yeah.
Yeah, and you have to, you know, you have to have your goals set out. I mean, what do you want to do? Do you want to be a commercial songwriter? Are you just doing this for your own satisfaction? In which case, you know, you don't really need to take anybody's advice because, you know how to satisfy yourself. But, you know, if you want to be competitive, you have to work at that. You have to work it.
Yeah, and that is great advice, and I know our budding songwriters and even experienced ones will take that advice to heart. We're coming up to about our 5-minute mark here. I want to get to Bobby Will's version of "Thank God for Second Chances" that you wrote along with Aaron Bates. Can you tell us about the initial idea of the story and then of the song rather, and then sort of how it got to Bobby Will's recording?
Well, this happened down in Nashville. Relatively close to the end of my years there, I had been working on a fairly frequent basis with Aaron Bates. Aaron is a female Aaron in this case, and she had a lovely voice. And in fact, I can tell you that the way I met her at one point, she had a development deal with Sony, and her manager had fallen in love with. Guess what? I want to live like that, and wanted her to cut that, and she did. In fact, she's one of the many people that did do a demo of it. But anyway, she lost that deal. Another one of these sad stories. And but in the meantime, I had gotten to know her, and we had started writing, and she turned out to be a good writer, and we would get together and do some really good stuff. And again, this title came from her. The basic premise came from her. She, you know, I guess it was during one of those times in Nashville when there was a lot of tornadoes going around, you know, the Tennessee area and the surrounding states, you know, Kentucky and Alabama. There are times when you're always turning the news on and you see the a newscaster out in the field interviewing some person whose house or mobile home or whatever has been swept away by a tornado, or and she wanted to write a song that captured a bit of that. But looking at the bright side of you know, as bad as that was, the important thing survived. We survived, and you know, we as a family can build everything again. I mean, that's the important. This is like another chance, another lease on life. That was kind of Aaron's premise, which I liked a lot. And so we wrote this song, and Aaron, of course, is a very good singer. And every other time that we had written, if we got around to demoing the song, she would be the singer. But in this case, right off the bat, she said, you know, I think this should be sung by a man. I don't know why, I just feel that. And
mm-hmm.
and so we did hire a male singer and went in and did a very good demo of it. And I played it for Bobby Wills, who lives in Calgary. Very good country singer, and he was doing an album, and we really thought that he would identify with the story that this song told, and he did. And he put it on his album. He released it as a single, I guess, last year, and didn't do as well at radio as we all hoped it would, but it's one of my favorite songs. Erin Bates claims it's her absolute favorite song that she's written.
Oh, great.
And so it's another one of these songs that you know, teaches a bit of a lesson. You know, you try to do this without being pontificating or whatever. But you know, I think it strides the line quite skillfully. So.
Yeah, that is a fine line as a writer, isn't it? When you're writing something, you don't want to sound preachy, come off like you're kind of forcing a message on someone to be grateful or to inspire them. But you got to do it in such a way that the message gets across, but not too overbearing.
Yeah, that's another one of those things that I guess beginning writers need to be aware of. I mean, songs are very, very good at delivering a message and, you know, teaching a little philosophy lesson and whatnot. I mean, there is something about the song format that really can work doing that job. But you have to be careful that you're not coming across like some sort of, you know, pontificating know-it-all, which can be off-putting for other people. So you know, you try and dress it up in a story or whatever, and just sort of let things unfold in a more or less organic fashion. But at the same time, you know, you're getting your little, live like you were dying message across. In the mix of things.
Now, do you have an ultimate pitch? You mentioned before, Larry, about Ron Irving, and he always wanted a Kenny Rogers pitch. Is there an artist that is that way for you? You're just waiting for the day when they choose to record one of your songs?
Well, you know, I have to say that, unfortunately, in recent years, an awful lot of the people that I, you know, really admired have, kicked the bucket, unfortunately. Ray Charles and Sinatra and some of the country singers, Vern Gosden, was a very iconographic kind of country singer. So you know, that's very unfortunate, because I would have loved to have heard some of these people doing my stuff. I've been trying to get a Michael Bublé cut for years, you know, trying to get stuff to him. He actually recorded a demo of mine years back when he was in Vancouver, before anybody had ever heard of him. But he's hard to get at now. Of the current country singers, there's a few that I really like. I like Blake Shelton and Joe Nichols a lot. I think they're both really really authentic sounding country singers. It'd be nice to have a Reba cut. I mean, Reba has now become sort of the high priestess of of country, you know.
Right,
having gotten
for sure.
A certain region. It would be very nice to get something cut by her. Trisha Yearwood used to be a huge favorite of mine, but again, you don't really hear her anymore.
Mm-hmm.
The career
yeah.
is kind of faded for her. But, any of those people, I would say Reba would be a strong candidate for, you know, somebody you could, you'd like to have bragging rights on that, you know. You know, haircut.
For sure. I'm going to encourage our listeners to head to LarryWayneClark.com because there they can read some of your thoughts on songwriting. And it's great to sort of explain your love of songwriting, how it started and through the years. And also if they just search you through Google, there's other blogs of yours and great writings that you do. And I also have enjoyed reading some of your music reviews recently, an Alan Jackson album, and there were a couple others there, and you really reviewed the albums. It was interesting to read them.
I did that quite a lot in both Vancouver and down in Nashville. I did a lot of work for Music Row magazine. Unfortunately, these days, it's hard to find work as a reviewer. There just aren't particularly paid work as a reviewer. There just aren't that many magazines left anymore. And,
right.
Which is kind of unfortunate, but, you know. Things change. I've seen an awful lot of changes in this industry during my my years. I'm sure you have. I mean,
oh, yeah.
Given the speed at which, you know, things like MP3s and Skype and all these things that are commonplace now that were unimaginable, you know, 15 years ago. You know, it's an ever-changing industry and. To some degree, you have to try and keep up with it.
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, there's so many new ways to communicate, but you still have to, whatever you're doing, still have a great message. We can, you know, have a million different ways to communicate something, but if we're not communicating something worth doing so, you know, the point is kind of lost.
And it's interesting also that in spite of all the ways that you can communicate now, a great deal of communication doesn't happen. You know, people fail to... to get back to you or to fully explain what's going on. You know, that's just part of being human, and I guess that's always going to be the same. You know, we always get frustrated by you know, miscommunications that lead to things going wrong in whatever way. but yes, I mean, you know, if you want to now, you don't ever have to spend a private moment in your life. I mean, you can be texting and phoning and sending pictures out into cyberspace every second of the day, it seems.
Now, is there a song in there somewhere, Larry? Is that something that you might write about, modern communication and the lack of it, miscommunication?
It sounds like a Brad Paisley song to me, but I don't think I've ever... fully address that issue in a song, but it definitely is a story of our times.
Definitely, definitely. Larry, it's been such a pleasure sharing this time with you and to get the stories behind these songs, to hear a couple of them, and hopefully our listeners got some insight into sort of how a song starts and the different steps along the way. And it's been a pleasure, and thanks so much for coming on the show, Larry.
Well, thank you, Dave. As always, I enjoyed it, and let's do it again one of these days.
Sounds good to me. We'll get that on the calendar. My guest today has been a songwriter, Larry Wayne Clark. And again, you can head to the internet anywhere on there, basically, as well as LarryWayneClark.com and hear some more of his songs. I'm Dave Woods, and I hope you've enjoyed following the journey of a song.
Spend some time in the country. We're glad that you dropped by. Spend some time in the country, leave your worries behind. There's lots of fun for everyone, the best in music too. Spend some time in the country, we've been waiting.